So hi, this is Gavin from FE News, and we're here today for the next instalment of our Unpacking podcast. Today, we're going to be unpacking the digital transformation of education. I've got the great pleasure to be joined by Anthony Tattersall from Coursera. He's actually the Vice President of Enterprise for Europe, Middle East and Africa. Anthony, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Anthony, what changes have you seen in education delivery from before COVID to now during COVID times?
So I think the biggest single shift has been that most of the educational institutions around the world, and in the UK as well, have had to go through a period of lockdown. And that's forced almost a mass experimentation in digital transformation, because people have had to adapt very, very suddenly to a new world that wasn't planned for, wasn't anticipated. And the core part of that, of course, is effectively providing education through an online mechanism rather than on campus. The challenge around that is it's not as simple as just doing what you did in lectures and moving into an online world and just simply saying, well, I'll just do it all on Zoom or Teams or Skype, whatever else, and so on. It's a little bit like taking a play and then filming that play and trying to say, this is what's not going to suit a movie going audience. There's a different set of expectations for people who engage in online forms of activity, whether it's education or anything else. And so in what we've seen is that there's different organizations have been had at different levels of being ready for something like this. Some have been very pioneering, have already been very well down a route of digital transformation, have been building lots of online content, and actually building capabilities to manage a much more diverse set and broader range of modalities for engaging with people in an education spectrum. Others who haven't been in that position have been forced to try and find ways to adapt to it and do that much more quickly. And so the goals of education in that sense have also had to shift a little bit. So if you look at the impact on individual students who perhaps were planning to come to campus, some of them will have lost their funding, especially international students, either partially or in full. Some may now only be able to support education if they're doing part-time work. Some will have lost the ability to travel or be unwilling to travel. Some may have to deal with personal care circumstances, whatever else it might be. And so if you're now going to engage with an educational institution through online capacity and you're not going to become an on-campus student, geography no longer really becomes that relevant. Okay, it's much more about whether you can learn in your local language and then whether the content suits you, but also the expectations of what a student will want from their educational program has shifted. People are looking for, I think, more flexibility. They're looking for the ability to learn in their own time, not just at very scheduled and very specific times. They're much, much more concerned about student employability outcomes at the end of their education. Knowing that we're going into a global recession for most parts of the world, I think one of the questions that students, if they're not asking, really should be asking is, how will coming to you as an institution give me more opportunity to move into the world of work than going to somebody else? And I think organizations are having to be much more explicit in addressing that question and much more focused on how they do that. And part of the answer to that question is ensuring that students are coming out of, whether it's an FE institution or any other form, with job relevant skills. And so there's a much bigger focus now on job relevant skills than perhaps the more academic side of education, which you could argue FE is more naturally suited to work in anyway. And so the adaption is perhaps a little easier. There are some other challenges. There are things such as how do you support faculty in dealing with an online audience or a much wider and diverse set of people coming into the process? How do you handle the capacity of it? What should an online experience be like? And bearing in mind, you're dealing in many cases with the iPhone generation. People are very used to engaging with online things in very user-friendly ways, very high standards of quality. Education institutions haven't built for that world. They don't necessarily know how to do it. They don't have the skills in-house to do it. They're going to either bring them in, figure out third parties, whatever else it might be. And the final piece is around cost management. If students are not going to go to a campus, then many of them expect to have a much lower cost of education if they're going to be accessing it remotely from home. But the university doesn't necessarily have any additional funding to draw upon. So you've got a whole cost management challenge, which can be partially offset if you can attract more international students in by offering a very attractive international option, an online option, but you're now competing with a global marketplace to make it happen. So a lot of dynamics, a lot of shifts taking place, but many of them I think will remain in place post-COVID.
Yeah, I agree. It's a really interesting landscape at the moment, isn't it? And you guys were really early into this to sort of help shape institutions of sort of delivering further down the line, really. And it leads me to many different questions. I'm really keen to sort of talk about institutions first of all. So
yeah,
it's really, can you share any interesting examples of best practice that you've seen in digital transformation and education across the whole education suite, really? Because to have that coming from, you know, a very senior person within Coursera is really interesting to our audience and to me. So I'd love to hear what you've seen is really cool best practice, really.
Yeah, so I think there's some broad kind of things that we can talk about, and then maybe we can look at some very sort of specific examples. I think from a broad capacity, there is a lot of focus on how you engage with people in a digital spectrum. And so what type of content you need, how is that evaluated, how is it tested, how do you build communities of people who are perhaps diverse and distributed and create this kind of online sense of community. There is a recognition, I think, that as we're moving into a world where education has become more focused on skills, the length of someone's time and work is expanding as our retirement age gets pushed out and life longevity expands, that it's highly unlikely that you will be trained in something and not need to be retrained at any point in your future working career. In fact, you'll probably be retrained multiple times and have to reinvent yourself many, many times over as skills are outdating more quickly, as technology and data and things are coming in, are accelerating the need for skills redevelopment. So I think there's a really strong opportunity for institutions to become partners in the kind of career moments in someone's journey, not just the perhaps the sort of 16 to 21 range of education, but at all stages of someone's evolution of an individual throughout their career and really moving into that more of a lifelong learning piece. And so I think one of the big best practice areas we're seeing is that organizations are looking to partner with businesses and engage more directly with the market that their students will be moving into. To support people in career transitions as well as entry into a world of career. And also embracing that nobody can be brilliant at everything. So it's recognizing where are you really, really strong? What is your kind of niche areas of capability? And then bringing in other organizations, other third parties to ensure that their students are as well-rounded as possible in the skill sets that they need. And in some cases, this is bringing in content from other institutions, other universities or colleges. And you're actually presiding over the kind of curation of those different options to give a fantastic degree that leverages what you're brilliant at, but also what other people are brilliant at that is perhaps your not area of core competence. Others are also bringing in things like business quality content. So one of the things that Coursera has on their platform, we have a lot of content from people like Google and Amazon and IBM and so on. And actually leveraging that type of content, which is industry created, designed to give qualifications and skill sets that are almost certified on the marketplace that will help people move and transition to careers and building that in as part of the actual formal academic program. And then recognizing that there's a piece that sort of says, how do we accredit this? So moving into almost a recognition that accreditation of content could be presiding over multiple sources, only some of which originated from yourselves. And then, of course, building in flexibility in how you engage with those different programs in multiple ways. So those are kind of, the, I think, they're kind of the really broad themes. We are seeing a big evolution, of course, in educational options being moved on to online. We're seeing real growth in online degree programs. You've seen things like Imperial College in London, which has got masters now in public health, something that resonates, of course, very much in the times of pandemic. An MSc in machine learning. And so we're seeing that institutions are recognizing the shift in what people care about and what organizations are after. There's a massive, massive focus for most companies now in areas such as data science and tech capability, because those skills are evolving so quickly and almost everybody's looking for the same skill sets coming in. There's just not enough people in the marketplace. So as an institution, if you were able to orientate the courses that you're delivering to students that we know are going to be in high demand, those skill sets, you're obviously going to drive better employment opportunities for your students. And then if you look at something like, for example, the University of London, if you look at their Bachelor of Science in Computer Science, then there are multiple pathways to access this. So it's been broader in the way of enabling accessibility for students. So for example, 25% of the students in that particular BSc have been enrolled in the Google IT certificate. And that is something that is then used as a prior accessibility criteria to access the program because it's still a recognized quality level of skills and is certified by Google themselves and for the roles that they might want to hire against. And so again, that broadening of partnerships with industry and having different ways of different gateways for people to access programs, I think also gives us an opportunity to improve diversity and accessibility for different communities and users. And recognizing now that every institution theoretically is part of a global competitive landscape and marketplace, we do need to be sensible in recognizing that the more diverse we can be, the more pathways we have to access our curriculums, the more long-term support we can give, the more broad our curriculum is, and the better our reputation can become because we leverage best practices that are not necessarily invented here, and leveraging those partners, the more attractive we will be to individuals wanting to join us, and the easier we'll be able to manage cash flow challenges and respond to the very uncertain future that still lies ahead of us in the next year.
Yeah, very much. So I think one thing that Coursera is able to do is to give choice to students and learners, isn't it? And I think that's really interesting that you're sort of showing different examples of where institutions are working with businesses. Are other institutions, you know, pooling together? Because like you said, you can't be expert at everything. And I think one thing I've always found really interesting with Coursera is you can have the experts for certain, you know, modules, semesters, mm-hmm. you know, to actually then, you know, pull together as a student, you could have that choice. But are institutions encouraging that as well? Or is that sort of yet to sort of come?
I think it varies, of course, across institution, but we're definitely seeing a really strong trend that is positively suggesting that's starting to take place. And a lot of the data for us comes from our initial response to when the pandemic sort of first kind of really kind of kicked in across the world in sort of March timeframe. And we launched an initiative where we made all of Coursera's content freely available to students and institutions anywhere in the world. And that drove huge, huge interest. We had more than 3,700 institutions sign up to that program. And 2.5 million students, I think, to date now are actually learning on Coursera, but through their university programs. And those universities are leveraging content from 170 other institutions around the world and probably 30 or 40 businesses. And so we've seen a huge level. We've seen 11,000 UK students learning on Coursera through, you know, UK higher educational institutions. We've seen over 100,000 enrollments in courses on the platform. So there's been a real desire to access that kind of caliber of information. What we've also seen is that in many, many countries around the world is that governments are legislating now to say either X percent of your education has to be online, or at least you have the right to do so. And there is a real move globally and in all countries, I think, to recognize that online is not only something that has to be made available in response to the pandemic, but actually should be something in the future that we do as a permanent adaptation to the way educational provision is made to increase their flexibility. And what we are seeing are the ones that who are embracing the online learning, most of them are saying, look, it's going to take us years to build this content if we just do it ourselves. And why do we need to? Like, why do we need to build everything ourselves? Why don't we take some of the best in class stuff that's out there, leverage those brands that add iteratively to our own? But the reason that people are going to join us is because of our values and our position in the world and what we represent and the connections we have with our employers and so on. It's not really the fact that we created our own content that will drive people towards you. It's the overall experience that you can bring to bear as a partner. And I think there is a real recognition that you don't have to do everything yourself. It is a much more effective way to partner. It can give you a lot more dynamism and much more choice, very much more rapidly broaden out your capability sets, and you can adapt much more quickly by sharing the challenge across multiple organizations. And I think we're seeing that often more quickly in emerging countries, perhaps where there are younger systems, they've got less legacy, they've got less legislation that might get less bureaucracy. In the UK, I think the UK has such a very long and proud history of education, but that also can create a sense of inertia. And so whilst we have some incredibly pioneering organizations in the UK, we have many, many that are still in the, you know, our world has been like this for 100 years. We don't see the need to change. The pandemic will go and we can go back to doing what we always did. And I think that's really, really risky. I think the decisions that are made now will have very, very long-term ramifications for your future survivability as an institution. And in 5 years or 10 years, if you start your catch-up, then it's probably too late. You know, it's going to be very hard to reclaim lost space. And you become in this then declining cycle of you're losing interest, you lose funding, you lose students. It becomes harder and harder to invest to take that step forward. So I think the more enlightened organizations are recognizing that change has to happen. There's a big question about what it needs to look like, but change has to happen. And we need to embrace that digital transformation, both within and how we engage with students globally.
Yeah, very, very much. It leads to my next question, actually, beautifully. So what do you see as the future of blended learning? Because we're in this during COVID time, and it seems like this, it's only been, you know, several months, but we're hopefully going to be moving into, you know, after COVID times. And it, like you said, you know, could we be seeing the future of, you know, seminars being both a blend of in-class and also virtual, you know, international students with, you know, nation sort of centric approach as well. What do you see the future be? Because that's really exciting around what does that mean for the future of blended learning. It then leads on, I want to ask you a bunch of stuff around stackable skills as well, because you've alluded to it a number of times.
Yes.
And it's just how does that sort of, how do we move then with stackable skills, and what could the future of blended learning be? I'd be really excited to hear what you've got to say about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd be surprised if anybody felt blended learning isn't going to be something we're going to see a lot more of, and it's going to become, you know, much more fully embraced. And again, I think it's also really important to say that we certainly believe that educational institutions are here to stay for the long term and have a huge value to contribute. Right? So this is not about replacing it. It's not about moving all to off, you know, to offline asynchronous type content, which is all self-service and you do your own thing. And there's a huge value that professional educational teachers and students and institutions can bring, and the understanding of how you knit all of that together cohesively. And it's not just the education, it's the pastoral care, it's the learning as a young adult, it's the preparing yourself for the life of the work, and all of those kind of things. So there's a huge value in it. But we also have to recognize that the way in which our students will either necessarily be able to engage with us or want to engage with us is going to be much more blended. It's applying to every form of working life that we have, from how we order food, to doing shopping, to how we do work, to taking a taxi, to whatever it might be. There's a coming together of the physical and the virtual, the online and the offline, the communities and socials, and the doing stuff in your own time. And education isn't immune to that. It has to recognize that that is the direction of travel and the normal expectation of individuals, that it will be blended and there'll be a combination of flexibility where you can do stuff in your own time, in your own way, but opportunities to also work with cohorts or communities of students and get that sense of collaboration and working together and teamwork. Bringing those two things together effectively with some flexibility in how it's managed will give educational institutions far more opportunity to compete globally, but also much more flexibility in how they can shift things around, because it necessarily means you have to be more flexible in your approach, which means you can be more interesting and adaptive in the way you actually try and evolve your educational programs.
Can we talk about the Global Skills Index report? Because yeah, we talked about institutions and then what does that mean for blended, but it's... like you're saying, a lot of the driver for Coursera is all around employability and having the skills which employers are requiring and needing. So I wanted then to sort of do this next section to be around skills. And the Global Skills Index report was really interesting, actually. So what trend in skills are you seeing in the UK compared to international at the moment? Mm-hmm. And why do you see it's important that people continue to learning for life?
So the Global Skills Index is a report that is now in its sort of second year of running, and it really takes into account data across our entire network. And so we've got more than 70 million users on the Coursera platform that we can take this massive data set from and really start drawing out what are the comparisons between different countries or even different industries within those countries, and how do people compare in terms of different skill sets. Now, if you look at what we're seeing happening, and specifically looking at the UK, in Europe, Europe generally is pretty strong in this report. So European countries pretty much take all of the top 10 spots in the GSI, the Global Skills Index rankings for tech and data science. There are some other leaders in sort of the business leadership capacities, but tech and data science are really your hard skills. And these are the skills that the vast majority of hiring is going on for right now. And the vast majority of reskilling has to take place because those skills expire so quickly. The UK is definitely lagging behind some of our European countries in some of those skills. So it is ranked 20th in Europe for tech skills, 23rd globally. And relative to really the perception of the high quality of education that the UK has and its global standing, I really think we should be in the top 10, or certainly aspiring to be for tech skills. Similarly, we're ranked 18th regionally in Europe and 24th globally for data science. So when you take into account things like Brexit, you take into account the shifting of the world economy, the opening up of global competition, the fact that people, not just education, but also in the form of work, there's a lot less reliance on offices and locations so people can work more globally. Again, as an individual, you may be competing for a job that might be based in Birmingham, but could be competing with people in India or Russia or the US, because they could work from anywhere subject to visa requirements. So it's really important that we are empowering our individuals within the UK, if we want the UK to be strong in those areas of capability, to have the best possible skills in the marketplace so we can effectively differentiate and we can make sure that our students are successful. If you look at the UK specifically, if you look at things like business skills, the top five trending skills in business are actually things that are around things like project management skills, using Microsoft Excel, using pivot charts, financial understanding. If you look at tech skills, it's around things that people in technology will recognize, I'm sure, around Jira, around C programming, around data structures and around algorithms. And then data science, Python, which is just huge in the world of data science, machine learning, multitask learning, and so on. So this is what we're seeing people in the UK mostly choosing off their own recourse to spend their personal time investing in those skills. Bearing in mind a lot of the educational access to Coursera, some of it has been mapped to CLEAR programs and has been delivered as part of a curriculum. A lot of it is being given to students in the sense of, we've been forced into shutdown, here's something for you to learn with, and you've got a lot of freedom to choose what you want to engage with. So this is suggesting that what we're seeing in the UK is this is what students think they should learn, that's important to them, either because they have a passion for it or because they think that will improve their employability outcomes. So that kind of data is really powerful for institutions to work with, to see like what do people think they need to engage with? And if they are engaging with it outside of your formal curriculum, they clearly think they're not getting that from within your curriculum and it's needed in order for them to improve their prospects. So maybe you should actually look at this and see, can you bring it into your program in a more formal way and perhaps bring it in for more of a 4-credit type program?
And is there institutions using the Global Skills Index report findings for like careers advice and guidance to students for either coming onto a program or to sort of extend program, like that stackable skills sort of approach again?
So I think we've seen it being used in multiple different ways. So it's a very broad report. So it looks at obviously industry, it looks at skills. So it's been used by industry organizations to see where they are performing, where the industry is performing, where they should invest their own internal development programs. It's being used by governmental organizations to look at what are the future skills. And from a government perspective, in many cases, there's a general concern across lots of organizations, the UK included, that many of the jobs that are done today will be automated in part or in full over the next few years. And if we haven't invested in reskilling our people, they will become employed and they'll be on benefits, and that's a high cost to support unemployment. It's a much, much more sensible and much lower cost to invest in reskilling individuals who are in jobs at risk of being automated into roles that we know are in high demand. And so governments are using that to guide some of their citizen development programs. Universities and institutions and FE organizations have been using this to sort of see really where are the skills of the future, where are we strong. If there are clearly areas where the UK is lagging behind, this could be a great opportunity for them to come on board and basically say, look, the UK doesn't perform well here. We're going to make this something that we are exceptionally strong and world-class in, which then is a great, powerful mechanism to attract students into that organization. So as I said, people use it in lots of different ways. It's a ton of data that's in there. And I think there are lots of other data sources, of course, out there in the marketplace. But what's really important, I think, is for organizations to recognize, what does business want? How can they align better with it? We're in a very unique position in the sense we work with governments, we work with businesses, we work with individuals, and we work with educational institutions. And we very much try and be the bridge or the kind of hub for all of those things to connect up, because each of those has a connection point with all the other aspects. And we can strengthen those connections and improve awareness so it becomes a community that wraps around an individual to help ensure that their life chances are improved. That becomes really powerful. Our ability to help that is that we have the data on all of those aspects, so we can help inform decisions on how best to support people in what they will need now, but also what will set them up for the future.
Yeah, very right. And if it's got such a huge data set as you're explaining there, that's huge data for people to be able to understand what's happening right now and what sort of skills I need in the future. That's fantastic. Can we talk about what you see the future of lifelong learning potentially being, sort of not just now, but for the future? Because, you know, Coursera has come in and really helped education be able to sort of offer more choice, be able to offer more lifelong learning in different ways. So what do you see as that next stage? A lot of people, we've alluded to stackable skills and what does that mean? But what do you see that next stage, not just the now, but that next stage of lifelong learning could be?
So let me come to that just one second. So let me cover stackable skills just to clarify something, at least our perception on this. So our view of stackable skills is effectively that you're starting off almost with the most basic of units, like a single course. That can then be a part of perhaps a much broader specialization or a much deeper level of knowledge around a subject area, which could in turn lead to something which might be, say, a 6-month program of study, which could in turn lead to something like a degree. And so each of those stacks into the next, in the sense of that work doesn't have to be redone. It can be reutilized in bigger pieces, but it gives you options to kind of move as far down the path as makes sense for you and your learning and your interests and so on. And so, again, that's part of, I think, the new philosophy of learning, is that it's not like there's a single way. It's not like it's just your GCSEs, A-levels, your degree, right? There are lots of forms of ways in which people can be educated, whether that's on the job, whether it's through a bachelor's type degree, whether it's through more of an apprenticeship or a skills development program, whether it's informal or formal, whether it's in a partnership with a business or an academic institution or a skills-orientated program. And I think that will continue to grow. I think there'll be more recognition of what really matters is the skills, more so than the journey that took you to get them. But the journey matters in the sense of it gives you the way to qualify that those skills have actually been developed. And so that's where the institutions come into play, is that they need to have the recognition that they are capable to develop the skills that the world has needed. But there's still the skills that fundamentally matter. Now, if we then look at lifelong learning, I really believe that in the future, we're going to see a real coming together of government, of business, and of educational organizations in a much closer way than we've seen in the past. And the driving forces for that are fundamentally, it's the rapid evolution in skills development. So the lifetime of a technical skill today is probably about 2 years. Even a business or leadership skill is probably only 5 years. And that perhaps seems strange to some people, like how can management kind of fundamentally change in 5 years? Well, you think management today, a lot of the things were not taught, and certainly my time of learning as a manager, will be things like, how do you run a virtual team? How do you handle very highly diverse teams? How do you handle international teams that work in different countries? How do you handle a team that now has to be led by data insight and is fundamentally delivering insight back to the business, which you probably didn't even think about before because data science didn't exist as a discipline. So all these skills are evolving, recognizing there are other tech and hard skills that are actually affecting the way we just operate as a business. Even the way an organization used to be valued, if you look at things like the FTSE, it used to be more about physical goods and stock and assets. And now it's intellectual property and it's people skills and it's the ability to leverage data and use that to drive competitive advantage. And that's why we see so many tech companies dominating many of the major indices. So that will have shifted significantly. But if you recognize that my working life might now be from 18 to 21 to 70 or even 80 by the time you get there for some of the students today, that could be a 60-year working career in a world where skills are changing every 2 to 5 years. And jobs are changing fundamentally. Functions are changing. Companies are reinventing themselves. Digital transformation isn't a one-time thing. It's a constantly evolving thing year over year over year. It's highly unlikely anyone will have a job for life. It's much more likely that people will do 5 or 6 major stints of types of work, which will have their own little evolutionary and upgrading paths. There's a lot more on the lateral development shifting around. The world is trying to be much more diverse in the way it thinks about people and how you can drive internal mobility and move people and how people can transfer across and drive internal mobility. So all of those things create a much bigger sort of sense of careers will shift frequently and there'll be more flexible options and different ways of engaging, but it can only be manifested if you have the skill sets to take on the next step. And those skill sets don't come because a student just naturally evolves in their current role. They have to be taught. So there are four major routes of how you learn those skills. There is the business you're working with, who may give you learning opportunities to develop skills not within your core competency right now because they care about internal mobility. That might help you with certain roles in that organization, but it won't help you for roles that they don't have that are outside the organization. So that's somewhat limiting by nature. You've got governments who will really care about not having people with skills that will no longer be viable in the job market in the next few years. And so need to make sure that their citizens have access to programs that will keep them gainfully employed. And you'll have educational institutions whose core business today is about education, but I think it's actually moving more into skills development than purely seen as an education provider, who could, I think, be best equipped to manage those transitional life points of individuals throughout their entire journey and be true partners to both government and business, which also really broadens out what they do as an organization. It means their, if you like, lifetime value for a student is not 4 years, it's 60 years. That's a very different value proposition and a very different set of offerings that you could bring to the marketplace, but much broader in scope as well. And then the final person, of course, is the individual themselves. Like individuals have the ability through self-learning to reinvent themselves, and many, many people do on our platform and have gone from a world where they've been unemployed or in war-torn countries and suddenly they manage to get themselves a got job in Google because they've invested in their own development. So there's always going to be that opportunity. But I think from a society perspective, we can't just rely on individuals figuring this out for themselves. We need to support societal growth. And the educational institutions we have in this country are very strongly placed to do that because they come from that approach. They have a pedagogical approach in terms of the way they design these programs in the first place. They have a genuine passion and interest in developing individuals and creating opportunity for them. And it's their core function. A business's core function is not learning. Business core function is making TVs or selling cars, right? It's not learning. It's a side project that they recognize as essential. But if you could outsource that project to an academic institution who just does this every single day, that I think is the real opportunity for that partnership to evolve over time.
That's really cool. Anthony, if you could dream and dream big, what do you see the future of online learning and also the future of education to be?
So I would say that if I start from a very highest level, I think that education is probably the single greatest force for good in the world. Most of, I think, the issues we have, whether it's war, whether it's poverty, whether it's lack of work, come from ignorance or a lack of education or a lack of appreciation of other persons' perspectives. So education, I think, is a massive, massive force for good for the world. Education, I believe, should be a right that everybody has access to education. And I would love to imagine a world, I think it will take us longer to get there than I'd ideally like it to, but I'd love to imagine a world where every single person, irrespective of age, of gender, of background, of country, has a relatively equitable access to education and access to some of the best education in the world, so that they all have an opportunity. You know, and I deal with lots of countries that have emerging economies, and it is not about a lack of capability. It's only a lack of opportunity that prevents people doing as well as anyone in a very mature and very strong, vibrant economy. And so I think if we can, through the UK, through other countries, through other educational institutions, really develop a global accessibility to education, leveraging best practice, leveraging flexibility so people can engage in whatever mechanism suits their way, recognizing there'll be different accessibility requirements for in terms of funding and capabilities, and that will never completely go away, but at least as a baseline access that everyone has some opportunity to improve their life outcomes through education, that can only be an amazing force for good. And I think it will evolve in the lines we talked about in terms of lifelong learning measures. And we can bring accessibility with innovation and transformation and lifelong learning together, it'll just be a much happier world to live in.
Anthony, thank you so much for your time. So I could talk to you for hours and hours and hours, and maybe we can do this again in the future. But thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for helping us to unpack digital transformation and education so much more. Thank you so much, Anthony.
You're very welcome.
I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Why not click subscribe so you can be informed when the latest next individual podcast or podcast mini series from FE News are going to be released.